Don't waste a second coding yet another login registration system. Use Product Structure to dynamically provide your site with turnkey solutions for user engagement, all through a single line of JavaScript. From registration to importing contacts to inviting friends, our products come with a built-in A/B testing engine to ensure you have the best methods to manage your users. Product Structure. Focus on your core application and let us serve you the rest.
Come to Chicago Airline Factory Light on October 4th and listen to airline talks from Alexander Gunaris, Susan Potter, Adam Densberg, Christopher Meckeljohn, Evan Miller, Mahesh Mahalani Subramaya, Garrett Smith, Corey Haynes, Jesse Gum, and Sean Cribbs. Use the discount code MOSTLYERLINE to get a 15% discount when you register on the Erlang Factory website.
Hello, and welcome to episode number 14 of the Mostly Erlang podcast. Today we're going to talk about MegaCore and the challenges that are coming down the road for all of us who are developers and what we may be facing in the next few years. And we are joined by a couple people. We've got Kevin Hammond from the University of St. Andrews. Kevin, introduce yourself, please.
Hi, Zach. So I'm Kevin Hammond from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and I'm the coordinator of the Paraphrase project, which is trying to bring MegaCore computing to Erlang or vice versa.
And we have a couple of guys from Erlang Solutions. Can you introduce yourselves?
Sure. My name is GTO. I'm from London, UK, and I'm one of the senior Erlang developers.
Hi, and I'm Robbie Rushka, and I also work at the London office of Erlang Solutions as a developer.
All right, and I'm Zach Kessen, and I'm author of Building Web Applications with Erlang, and I'm working on also a new book called Testing Erlang, which is you can find it on GitHub. I'll put the link. It's at a fairly early phase, but feel free to send a pull request. So before we get started with our topic, there are a couple of announcements. Erlang Factory Lights, there are four of them coming up. On September 14th, which is a Saturday, we have Erlang Factory Light in New York. So that'll feature Fred Haber and a bunch of other people. A few weeks later in October, we have Chicago. For those of you who might be on the other side of the Atlantic, we have Berlin coming up later in October. And then following that, Tel Aviv, October 23rd. Call for proposals still open. Feel free to submit one, and if you'd like to see a little of Israel while you're here, I happily introduce you to point you some useful directions or introduce you to a tour guide. Tel Aviv's a great city if you've never been, and even if you have been. So that's sort of the announcements. Also, Erlang Camp Nashville is coming up. Any other announcements, guys? Anything cool coming up?
Not from our side.
Okay. Okay, so let's start with just defining what do we mean by MegaCore? I mean, it sounds very impressive, but what is it? What specifically do we mean by it?
Yeah, so as you can't have failed to notice, Zach, we're in an era when the number of cores on a chip is rapidly increasing. From about 10 years ago, in 2006, when Intel started to market their first dual core computer, we've scaled up to 4, to 8, and even to 12 or 16 cores on a single chip. What people are predicting is that this trend is just going to keep continuing because of the major demands of power, energy usage, and because of the inability to basically scale computing power on single chip designs. We expect this trend to just continue. So already in 2013, Intel have announced a 40-plus core chip, the Intel Xeon Phi. And in the future, what we can predict is that this trend will just keep increasing so that we have thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even millions of cores on a single computer. And that's what we mean by a mega-core computer.
Just a quick aside question. I've seen some chips, say they have, 4 cores or 6 cores or 8 cores or whatever. And some chips say they have, 4 cores with 2 threads per core. So what's the difference between a chip that has 4 cores but 8 total threads and one that just has 8 cores?
Okay, so this is a fairly technical point. But essentially, this is a device that Intel have used early on to increase the availability of the hardware on a single chip. So within a single CPU, there are many functional units. And one of the ways that you can get some parallelism is by using some of these unused functional units to run another thread of computation. So when Intel tells you that they have two threads per core, what they're telling you is they have a single CPU, and some of the units, some of the integer units or floating point units or whatever, are being used to run a second thread. Okay, so it's not a real second core. It's just an illusion that you have a second core available to you.
Right. I think my laptop may do that. It looks it pretends to have four cores. Tonight it's a MacBook Air with an Intel i5 in it, I think.
That's right. So a lot of the chips will do this. And if you're very lucky, then you can use if you have, for example, computations that maybe don't use the same type of unit. If you have one computation using a lot of integer, another computation using a lot of graphics, or floating point, then you can actually get twice the speed out of your single physical core. But if you're unlucky, and you have, say, computations that all use a lot of integer computation, then of course you don't get any speed up, and you might even get slowdown from your computations.
So the AMD chip that has eight flat out cores has a certain advantage over the Intel one that has six with two pipes each, or two threads each.
Depending on your computation.
Right.
So sometimes the Intel one will give you better performance, and sometimes the AMD one will give you better performance. What's true is that it's easier to scale on the AMD chip, because you really do have completely independent CPUs.
Okay. Whereas the Intel one, they're faking it, but it's not really completely independent.
That's right. It's not completely independent.
So, okay. So that's a good definition, because, you know, I'm sure I'm not the only one who's looked at that and sort of scratched their head and said, what does that mean anyway? Now Intel, you said, has introduced a 40-core processor. And
yes,
I think IBM may have a power processor that has 32.
That's right. So the Intel chip is actually quite interesting, because this was formerly intended to be a graphics processing chip. This was the Intel Larrabee. They've just released it this year as the Intel Xeon Phi, and it has 40, or possibly in some future configurations, 60 cores on a single chip. It's a real beast of a chip.
And the other thing to point out is that the individual cores are not getting faster, and in many cases are actually slower than they were a couple of years ago, right?
That's right. So on the Intel Xeon Phi, for example, although we have 40 or more cores, each of the cores is only running at 1.1 gigahertz, which is a lot slower than even my laptop. My laptop is running at 1.6 or maybe 2 gigahertz. But this is part of the energy equation. As you ramp up the speed of the chip, so the energy consumption per core roughly doubles. Whereas if you add more cores, then the power consumption scales linearly with the number of cores. So by adding more cores, you're getting more performance for the same amount of power.
Right, and then for the same amount of heat dissipation.
And heat dissipation, yeah.
Yeah, actually, interestingly, if you've ever read the book Startup Nation, which is all about the Israeli tech scene, they talk about it was the Intel group up in Haifa, up in the north of Israel, that sort of came up with this whole multi-core strategy, which was, they apparently had a rather tough time convincing everybody it was a good idea at first. Because the rule of thumb in those days was more megahertz good, less megahertz bad. And they went, well, no, not really. And it took a while. Or at least they were partially responsible, I'm sure.
I think part of that is that it's a lot easier to program a single CPU. So once you move to a multi-core, then you have to start thinking about multiple threads of execution. And, of course, with most conventional programming languages, you then have real problems of synchronization, communication, etc.
Right.
And this is where functional languages like Erlang or Haskell come in.
Yeah. Haskell's one that's broken my brain every time I've tried to use it.
I'm sorry to hear that, but take a couple of monads and you'll feel a lot better.
Well, I actually use the Orlando Monad Library in Erlang quite a bit. One of these days I will learn Haskell. Really, I will. But it hasn't happened yet. And my current language learning project is something rather outside the functional space in that I've been playing with a little bit with R. Just because it's solving some problems I have right now with terms of analyzing data. So how, you know, the obvious way you solve this in Erlang is create lots of processes. But what are the problems we're running into?
Well, the problems that we're potentially running into is that we don't just need a few processes. We need many, many processes. And as you start to add more processes, so the problems of programming the systems become much more complex. It's pretty easy to program with a few threads, but when you're programming with tens of thousands, millions, or maybe tens of millions of threads, then the whole problem just becomes vastly more complex, Zach.
Right. So, I mean, I assume what becomes complex is not having 10 million threads. It's coordinating between them.
That's right. And structuring your problem so that you have enough threads to keep your processor working, but not so many that you pay too much overhead per thread. So this is the basically crux of the problem.
Right. And then you have things like Amdahl's law that are going to pop up from time to time to annoy you.
Yes, absolutely. So Amdahl's law basically says that you can't, that there are indivisible units of work, and once you hit something which is sequential, that potentially is going to dominate your entire computation.
Right.
So you sometimes have to be clever about your algorithm. And one of the things that we try to convey to people is that they have to think parallel. Most programmers today have been brought up in university or through work to program to optimize sequentially. But often that's the wrong thing to do, particularly if you're dealing with a computer which might have millions of execution units.
Right.
Often what you have to do is to just rethink the problem completely, sometimes go back to first principles and start to think about different types of algorithm, parallel algorithms.
Yeah, and unfortunately, many of us were not afraid of that. Just to go back to Amdahl's law, the analogy, it's possibly an imperfect one that I like to give people, is imagine you went to a bank and it had 50 tellers, but only one of those machines to count the cash. You know, the bank could only process people as fast as that machine can count the cash, because it becomes your indivisible unit of work. I'm not sure that's a perfect analogy, but I think it sort of gets the idea across.
Yes, that's right. That's a good analogy, thing.
Yeah, well, either that or only have one printer, either one, you know. So whenever I don't know about the banks there, but whenever I go to my bank here, they inevitably print out six pieces of paper and have me sign them all, saying, you know, whatever it is they say, I don't know. So, yeah, I mean, but it sounds like we are going to have a lot of cores. Professor, there was a great talk at Strange Loop, I think last year, by Professor Abelson of MIT of Wizard Book fame, entitled "We Don't Know How to Compute." Did you see that by chance?
Yeah, unfortunately, I missed that. But maybe you should fill us in about it.
I don't remember it very well. I'm just see if I can pull it up. He did say that he thought Haskell was the nicest language of all of the out-of-date languages he's learned, although he did clarify, and I'll post a link to the video here. Oh, no, it wasn't Ableton. It was Gerald Sussman. And summary is Gerald J. Sussman compares our computational skills with the genome, concluding that we are way behind in creating complex systems such as living organisms, and proposes some ideas for improvement. The Wizard Book, Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programs, I know that I had this as a freshman computer science student back in 1991, and I still have a copy sitting on the shelf behind me 20 mumble years later. So one of my favorite programming books. But yeah, I think functional languages are going to be a big part of that. Besides Erlang and Haskell, are there any other ones we should be looking at for this?
Well, I think any language which adopts a basically functional approach is potentially good for parallelism. And there's a huge explosion of interest in functional, mostly functional languages. So languages like F Sharp, like Clojure, like Scala, and of course ML Camel. These are all potentially very very good for parallel programming.
Just a note that our prior episode, which isn't up as we're recording this, but by the time you hear it will be, is actually on F Sharp. So if you want to learn more about F Sharp, go listen to that. Brian Hunter hosted that, and we will probably have episodes on all those other languages at some point in the future that have not been scheduled yet. So if you're interested in any of those things, just, you know, keep subscribing. We'll get there. I've liked functional programming since I first discovered Scheme back in the early 90s. And I'm just
I forgot to mention Scheme.
Yeah. And I'm just glad I discovered Erlang, which gives me an excuse to use it for, you know, my day job. Because our company's APIs are all written in Erlang. So, you know, it sounds like we have a lot of work to do to get these megacore projects working. Besides simply creating a lot of processes in Erlang, what else do we have to think of? And new algorithms, like what else should we be thinking about?
Well, there are all kinds of issues when programming in parallel, Zach. So, luckily, if you start from the right approach, so if you start from a language which is basically mostly functional, if you encapsulate your computations using lambdas or other pure functional constructs like the Erlang process construct. And then start to build up to large parallel structures, then you can at least crack the basics. But there are a lot of things we have to consider. So performance obviously is a major one. We have to also consider energy usage, and there may be memory usage. There may be all kinds of things that we have to worry about. And in sequential programming, we're not used to thinking so much about these anymore.
Yeah, actually, I mean,
kind of reversion to previous programming techniques.
Listening to some guys talk about mobile development, or read an essay recently, where talking about whether JavaScript was appropriate for mobile, and they pointed out that, you know, garbage collection techniques, which work great on the pretty well on the desktop, kind of fall flat when you're in sort of an embedded space like a mobile device, where you just have much more limited resources than you would in, a desktop. You know, and I actually was at a lecture that Google gave a while back on programming for Android, and they were pointing out all sorts of things that us desktop developers, you know, or server developers never think about. Like, if you're developing an app for a mobile phone, every time you talk to the internet, it has a cost in that you turn on some piece of radio of RF gear, be it the Wi-Fi or the 3G or what have you, or the Bluetooth, I guess. That drains your takes battery, and if you build an app on a phone that proceeds to kill your user's battery in 2 hours, you're not going to have many happy users. You know, I think it's sort of the same idea that suddenly, when you change the rules of the game, you suddenly realize you have to pay attention to a whole different set of problems.
I think part of it has to do with separation of concerns. Partly, you know, part of the reason why I'm so interested in Erlang is because I don't want to have to worry and deal with multi-core. I just want my application to just work. And
right.
For many cases with Erlang, with the current Beam implementation, we know that we can go up to about 15 cores and have near linear gains without changing your code. That to me is As a programmer, that to me is the calling card where Erlang gives me, you know, the edge over, say, a Java programmer, or a Java VM, or even a Ruby VM. And you know, there's a company called Concurix. They propose that with their software, they can analyze your Erlang code, and they've demonstrated to themselves that in any case, that they can get near linear increases in your Erlang code up to about 128, and they're targeting 512 cores without any changes to your code. I mean, that to me is the value of not having to worry about cores and what I need to do to get my program running on them.
Yeah, that makes sense. They're actually going to be on the podcast in some point in the future. I forget. Sometime in September. We'll be recording it sometime in September. They're scheduled. So yeah, we'll be talking to them as well. We're trying to get all sorts of people on here, as you may have guessed. You know, trying to sort of just sample who in the Erlang world. But you said they think they can get up to 512 cores?
Yes. Meaning up to 512 with near linear increase.
Right. So
yeah. When you can do this, this is fantastic. But of course, this only works where you have essentially independent computations, because as Zach was pointing out, Amdahl's law does bite you eventually.
Right.
So if your computation is easily decomposable, if you have threads which essentially are independent, which don't share any information, where there are no dependencies between a producer and a consumer, for example, then you can get really good speed up. The problems come when you do have these dependencies. For example, when a later thread can only execute when the result of an earlier one is produced.
Right. I mean,
That's hard, much harder to deal with, of course.
Right now, the way I have my I'm working on an application, and, you know, mostly the processes are independent, and I say mostly. But, you know, there are some ETSER and SEO lookups that happen in there over time, from time to time. And, you know, at the level we're at, that's fine. And I suspect even up to the 4 or 8 core level, that would probably be mostly okay. Especially since all the reads are dirty reads, because they're just for our particular use, that's fine. I don't really care if I have, you know, momentarily stale data. It doesn't matter. But I suspect sooner or later, if you start getting, especially start getting write heavy, that would seriously not work.
So one of the benefits of Erlang is that if you have a rough idea how your problem actually does decompose into all these parallel bits, then Erlang gives you the tool to implement your solution. A completely different strand that has been going on for ages is to attempt to find anything that can be automatically parallelized by the behind the scenes, and kind of a functional language does kind of give a little pointer in these directions in the evaluation order, where you can decompose functions and start executing things in parallel that will be used slightly later on. But that's quite a difficult research topic, and I'm not entirely sure how far along that has been going for the past 10, 20 years or so. But I think the research and the usage that has been going into the GPU approach to structure your code in such a way that you can execute pipelines across similar data.
Right. I mean, it seems to me the ultimate wrong approach is the Node.js approach, where you do every piece of decomposition that happens manually, every piece of asynchronicity. You have to explicitly do it with callback. That seems to me the ultimate wrong approach.
Yeah, you do need some kind of automatic help underneath your system. You don't want to do everything yourself.
Horrible. Kind of look at the asynchronous callbacks. I commented at some point, asynchronous callbacks are to 2013 what go-tos were to 1973 in, you know, languages like BASIC. You know, really kind of a good way to make a mess quickly. Remembering back to when I was doing BASIC as a kid on an Apple II. So
I would actually argue a lot of the issues that we would face with many, many processors running on massive cores are the kind of problems that we face today, partly because Erlang nodes are all interconnected into a mesh. So we do face some of those issues today where we have messages passing between nodes, which we may not want to have going on between processes.
Right. The other thing is, I'm assuming when you get into the mega core range, you know, nowadays, you know, on my computer here, which has four cores in it, you know, you can sort of just, the difference between sending a message between two processes on the same core and on a different core are, it's probably not no different, but you can sort of ignore it. I'm assuming when you're on a mega core system, that might not be true anymore.
It's no longer true, Zach. The hardware designers work very hard to create the illusion that all memory is equal cost. But the reality is that it isn't. And these future designs are going to expose that more and more to the programmer. Yeah. So some people in the non-functional world are already worrying about something called PGAS, essentially where your memory is partitioned. So PGAS stands for Partitioned Global Address Space. And the idea there is basically to break down the memory into different sections, each of which is local to a processor or a group of processors.
Sounds like something that people were doing in DOS back in like the early 80s or something.
Even worse than DOS, I think.
Yeah.
But this is essentially the only way that these memory architect, or one of the ways that people can see that these memory architectures can be tamed and exploited by conventional programmers. Of course, the problem then is you've lost the illusion of having a single address space. You've lost the ability, perhaps, to have one big array structure, and the code that you're writing becomes vastly more complex.
Yeah.
So the functional idea and the Erlang idea that things are automatically partitioned, that address spaces are distinct, and that the system manages this using all the complex memory management, garbage collection, etc., technology behind the scenes, has to be a much better way to program systems like that.
Right. I mean, it seems like Erlang is better than, say, trying to do it in C or Python. But it seems like at some level, it's only partway there.
But part of the thing with Erlang that I think everyone has to remember is it makes a lot of things simple. But that doesn't mean that everything is easy, and it tends to highlight problems that you may not come across in C++ or Java until much later on, simply because all the hard parts in C++ and Java and so forth are made easy in Erlang. So now you are faced with the harder problems to solve.
Right. It moves that line up a bit, but it doesn't get. But it's still there.
Yes. So, for example, I just came back from a client, and one of the comments they made was, we would never have done this in C++ in the amount of time that we took with Erlang. And it had exposed a lot of issues that we would not have seen or even come across in C++ simply because our software would have killed over long before then.
Right.
So that's one thing that, you know, anyone coming and drinking the Erlang Kool-Aid have to realize it's not a solution for all your problems.
Yeah, it seems like it's a better place to start than most.
Yes.
Although Haskell may get that as well. But just because it's a better place to start doesn't necessarily mean it's the best solution.
Think of it in this way. If you're jumping on a trampoline, you have to worry about the low ceiling. But if you're just trying to jump off the floor, you may not have to worry about your low ceiling.
Sure. So one of the things we're trying to do in the paraphrase project that I mentioned to you is to provide mechanisms to allow programmers to structure their code to make it parallel, basically to raise the ceiling a little higher, building on the basic Erlang mechanisms. So yeah. The idea is to try to identify patterns to get the programmer thinking in terms of naturally parallel patterns of computation.
So now, tell us a little bit about this project that you're working on. It's EU-funded, right?
Okay. So the paraphrase project, we coordinate the project from the University of St. Andrews. It also involves Erlang Solutions plus 12 other partners, both companies and academics, throughout the EU. So it's a three-year project, started last year, and it's going to run for just over 3 years. So it's a 4.2 million euro project, so a fairly significant investment of resources.
Yeah.
And basically what we're trying to do is to push back the boundaries to enable programmers to exploit the capabilities of systems like Erlang by helping them to think parallel.
Okay.
The way that we're doing this, so we're using a two-pronged approach. We're trying to identify very high-level patterns of parallelism, but then we're also trying to assist programmers by providing tools, refactoring tools, that enable them to rewrite their code so that it becomes parallel.
Okay.
And that, of course, has to include information about execution time, etc. So we're not completely arrogant. We don't expect to be able to completely automatically parallelize arbitrary code. Programmers have a huge amount of expertise, and what we hope to do is to enable programmers to become better parallel programmers using our tools and using these parallel patterns. So basic guidance and assistance to parallel programming.
Sounds like it's got some cool stuff going on there. And is any of this stuff that we could use, like, today?
There's I've given you a link, and there's...
You can repost it in the chat so I can put it in the show notes.
I was exposed to the initial forest, especially from the Erlang solution side of things. It definitely is very interesting work.
Thank you. Do you have the link, Zach?
This is the one you just gave me a little before the call.
Yes, I'll just copy it again for you.
Yeah, there are a couple there.
Yes, the first one is basics and material associated with the project. And what's there? There's a video showing our refactoring technology. There's a link to the GitHub source. What we're doing is still at research stage, but we're actively looking for interested partners to take up the technology. We would like to work with them to try to develop a user base in Erlang.
And just quickly, if somebody wants to, if somebody is listening thinking, hey, that would be perfect for my project, should they just send you an email?
Yeah, just get in touch with us. Send me an email. Zach, you've got my email address.
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes.
Put it in the show notes.
So just
contact us, and we're very, very happy to work with you. We're trying to build up a user community so we can provide you with some assistance with documentation. And at this stage, of course, you can be part of the tool development process.
I may play with it on our project. The problem is for us, we're sort of in a pre-release state where, honestly, running on one core, you know, we tested our system on an Amazon EC2 medium instance, and which is, you know, only one core, and it, let's just say if we had enough traffic to justify saturating one EC2 instance, right now we'd all be really happy at my office. Because the thing is, it's a project that hasn't launched yet. You know, we're hoping to launch it. We're a startup. We're hoping to have it launched by...
I think one thing there's one thing that is also important to understand as well is that even if you manage to get it running on multiple cores, you're still on one physical CPU unit. And if Joe Armstrong always say, if you don't have two of something, you don't have your redundancy.
This is true. You are one physical CPU, one physical Ethernet cable, one power supply, probably one hard drive.
Yeah. So no. The Erlang promise really must include the physical hardware to go along with it.
Right. No, we're going to actually, when we actually hit deployment, we're going to actually put it behind a load balancer and put it on two computers. But that's more about fault tolerance than performance, because honestly, one would handle the performance just fine.
Right.
So the second one is purely for fault tolerance, you know, it's mostly for fault tolerance.
Sure, Zach. But when you get your 2 or 3 million users, as I'm sure you hope to, then we can easily help you scale up.
Well, I will. Again, that's the point. I may call you. I will call you back, and we'll do a follow-up episode.
But I wouldn't want to. One thing is to not oversell the technology. So, one of the issues we found with Erlang is that occasionally code has unexpected dependencies. So we've been looking at a few programs recently where people have been using ETS tables, and these unfortunately turn out to be sequential blockers.
Oh, really?
Sometimes in the code.
What about Mnesia? Same deal.
We haven't looked at Mnesia yet, but anything where you have a single centralized resource that you're accessing, right, is potentially a huge bottleneck for a parallel computation. So you should think of these things as being basically like roadblocks in the middle of your parallel road. You've got a multi-lane highway, you're zooming down it at 70 miles an hour, and suddenly there's a toll booth. You have to stop.
I hit one of those every day on the way to work. Well, it's not actually a
booth, but same deal. So same deal. Except that here maybe we've got a million.
Right.
And now we've got to stop, synchronize, and proceed.
You know, what would be nice is if you had a tool similar to, say, Dialyzer, which I'm rather fond of, that would just do a static analysis of your code. Maybe Dialyzer could do this. I don't know. That wouldn't necessarily find everything, but would include, what do you call it? That would sort of catch the obvious cases of that.
Yeah, I would assume you could probably have a start with trawling through the code and having a look where you're using gen servers, which tend to be kind of essentially sequencers to access a resource sequentially. So that would be a main blocker.
Yeah, for our code, I think I'm just sort of wrong here.
And as far as I recall, the Paraphrase project actually has something of that sort of check when you do your compile from the Paraphrase language.
You know, like I said, Dialyzer does a nice job of static analysis. So if you had something that would, you know, come through and sort of say, hey, look, these are places where you have potential problems. I mean, I know in my code base we have some gen servers, but they tend to be in places where serialization is sort of where serialization isn't going to be a problem. You know, because we're doing things like loading data from somewhere else that can be sequential. You know, it can be sequential.
Right.
They're handling stuff that if it's, you know, if it backs up a little, it's not going to affect, you know, it's asynchronous. Everything else can just sort of carry on without it.
Right.
Whereas if you've got one thing that bit me is that, you know, sort of the really obvious one you would avoid is the IO format command in Erlang is sequential. And I had a case where I was running the Erlang terminal. This was not in production, obviously. This was just on my you know, development workstation. Inside Emacs. And it got blocked somehow. I had to just hit, you know, period and it started running again, but I hadn't done that. And then I hit it with a web request that had an IO format for debugging in it. And the whole thing just hung there because basically it can't complete the request until the IO format finishes. And then, of course, it couldn't print that out until the shell unlocked itself. So sort of a weird set of circumstances that probably wouldn't happen in production, but sort of a good example.
Now, that's something... And that's something you managed to find out. But what about all those libraries that we tend to end up using and we may not know about?
You know, right.
Hidden dangers like Lager and React and whatever else that is out there.
Imagine React's probably pretty good on this. They seem to get this stuff right, I think. But, you know, I mean, yeah, if you look at any largest Erlang project, 3-bar config file or whatever the equivalent is, there's probably, you know, 30 or 40 external libraries you're using, some of which, you know, and you know, if I look through my projects, 20 or 30, you know, external dependencies, if at least two of them didn't have some sort of sequential code in there that I wasn't suspecting, I'd be very surprised.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a couple of them, I know what they are, and there's nothing sequential in them at all, they're just pure functions. But there are a bunch more that I have no clue.
Right.
Yeah, yes, of course, serialization has crept into these libraries because people haven't had to worry in the past about parallelization. The problem is better in languages like Haskell and Erlang, and the problems of thread safety in C and C++ have been very, very serious, as people are, I'm sure, very, very well aware.
Yeah, I remember having a conversation about JavaScript, which used to be my sort of mainstay language, with somebody, and he was saying, you know, look, there's no, you know, it's single-threaded. And this guy's saying, well, they should have multiple threads for experts, you know, for the programmers. And I'm like, going, no, bad idea. You know, JavaScript has enough pitfalls. You don't need to add more.
One thing you might hope to do, as you were saying, was to provide a static analysis tool that will tell you this thing, this library, this program doesn't have any unexpected dependencies. It does have a good parallel profile that you can then exploit in your code. So some sort of certificate of good. This is good for parallel. This is good for parallelism. This is mega core safe.
Yeah, that we need a tool to do that. If you guys have, it's above my head. I know that, but somebody out there who's like looking for a master's thesis or something wants to write that. I don't know if that would be a good master's thesis or not. Email Kevin and ask him. You know, he's the university professor, and I'm not.
Absolutely, very happy to supervise anyone who would like to do such a project.
Cool.
And we have vacancies for PhD students as well.
Coolness. And I hear Scotland's nice, at least part of the year.
Yep. St. Andrews is beautiful, yeah. I would recommend anybody who is interested to go to St. Andrews University and do something there.
I lived in the UK for a year and a half, a long time, well, about 12, 13 years ago, but never made it as far as north as Scotland. Farthest north I got was York.
Okay, well, York is nice, but Scotland is beautiful.
So I've heard.
Next time you're here, do come visit us, Zach.
I would love to. Some folks are talking about getting me to come to London for talk at the London Erlang User Group. So if I can somehow make it up to St. Andrews, that would be amazing because, like I said, I've never been to Scotland. And I'd love to. My father's been, and he said it was great. I think he was there for some academic conference or another. He's on the squishy side. He was on the sort of squishy side of things. He's a microbiologist. So.
I have a question about paraphrase. What sort of new thinking or how would I go about, say, learning or even teaching paraphrase to somebody new? What are the gotchas that we have to look out for? And what's the paradigm shift from the process thinking that we're having today?
Yeah, I think this is a big question. At this stage, what we're doing is we're developing tools to assist current programmers and possibly future programmers. But the paradigm shift has to be one where we move away from mostly sequential programming and where we start to think of low-level serializing constructs in much the same way as we think of go-tos today. So I would say that there are many bad practices, and the bad practices include things, obviously, like a semicolon. This is a terrible thing to have. It's an automatic serialization.
The semicolon in terms of?
This happens, and then that happens.
Okay. Right. So you're thinking more, I'm thinking more like Haskell-ish, where just everything is lazy.
Not necessarily, no, and this is actually something we should discuss. But the point about a semicolon is that it's an artificial separator. It forces one thing to happen before the other. And what I'm really thinking is more like a function call where the arguments are passed in to the function. There's no required order, for example, amongst the function arguments if you have a pure computation.
Right.
No, so that's naturally parallel computation.
You know, the one thing Erlang does not have, at least as of yet, I think Costas' group might be working on it, is a way for a user-defined function for it to be marked as this, you know, this is a pure function. Like, I know I have one module I wrote, and it's a really simple module, it's probably all 15 lines of code, but everything in it is just a pure function. There's no, it has no side effects whatsoever. It really just decomposes symbolic time into sort of numeric time.
I mean, the sub-language of the guards has that particular requirement, and
yeah.
People always complain about it, but it's there for a reason. So
Yeah, no, I understand why you can't have a guard have your own function, because there's no way, you know, in Haskell you can say this function is a pure function. It's almost sort of by default. And then you could use it as a guard, but in Erlang, you don't know what that guard is going to do until, you know, there's no way to know if that guard has a side effect. Maybe it increments a counter somewhere when you call it, and then that would be bad. Whereas in Haskell, you know it won't. I don't know how to solve that problem.
Make everything pure.
But again, within the current language that is Erlang, even if the function is pure, there's no way to tell the runtime. There's no way to make the runtime enforce that, as far as I know, or to tell the runtime this is a pure function. We can guarantee that, and you can use it as such.
Yes. So way back when I did my PhD, I had to solve a similar problem for ML. So I was trying to implement a parallel dialect of ML, and you hit exactly the same problem, that if you have a pure function, then you can easily parallelize it. But if you have something which is impure, then, of course, you have to worry about the side effects and the interaction between different computations.
Just out of curiosity, where did you do your PhD?
I did my PhD at the University of East Anglia in Norwich in England.
Okay.
Okay, so you can look that up. So one of the things I had to do, as I said, was to produce just such an analysis. But it was very frustrating, because when you produce an analysis, you have to be conservative. So if you're not sure, then you have to assume there could be a side effect.
You'd rather think there was a side effect than... And you'd rather have a false positive than a false negative. Maybe I had that backwards. You'd rather say there is a side effect when there isn't than the other way around.
You have to, because if you don't, you can do things like replicating side effects, fail to synchronize. You can get inconsistent results. So that's the problem. It's the problem, of course, with imperative languages too. So ideally what you want is a situation where functions are pure by default and side effects are explicit. And, of course, that's what Haskell has.
Yeah.
So monads, the IO monad, and some other constructs explicitly capture the side effects and isolate them from pure code. So from a parallelism perspective, that's great.
But from
which is unfortunately for kind of the main building blocks of Erlang, which are processes and inter-process communication, which are side effects, makes it a difficult join to kind of bring together the architectural building blocks of Erlang with a potential automatic parallelism that's inherent in pure functions.
Well, in the Paraphrase project, what we're doing is to exploit the Erlang process structure. So you can think of the Erlang process structure as a kind of encapsulation mechanism. And then if you know what the effects are of a process, you can get good parallelization. You can avoid accidental side effects. I don't see the implementation necessarily as being a problem, provided you understand what it does.
With Paraphrase, as of today, is the GPU the only piece of hardware that I can try it on?
No, we're mainly, in fact, a lot of the things we're doing are CPU-based.
Okay.
So we're trying to deal with heterogeneous hardware. So we're trying to deal with both CPU and GPU computations. And the idea in the Paraphrase project is that by the end, we should be able to seamlessly move between CPU and GPU computations, by remapping the implementation of a pattern from a CPU to a GPU or vice versa. Depending on system requirements.
Is it possible to run Erlang on a GPU at this point?
It's possible. So our colleague at Erlang Solutions, Ed Tate, has a prototype running. So it's possible to exploit CPU code written in Erlang or callable from Erlang and have this run on GPU. But I haven't seen that in operation yet. I need to talk to Ed about all the details.
He did a demo of it a couple of months back, I believe.
At the Erlang user conference.
Internally, yes. The reason I brought the hardware up is because I was just wondering if you've heard of Adaptiva, the parallel.
Yeah, that got mentioned on the two episodes ago. Francesco mentioned it's got, I think, 16 cores, and maybe they've got a model with more.
Yeah, so I'm just curious if Paraphrase would run on something like that, simply because this thing is fairly cheap. I mean, it's retailing at about $100.
$99.
Yeah.
Yes, so the idea is that once you've got the basic low-level implementation, the high-level parallel constructs can be mapped to any architecture. So all the high-level parallelism is remappable to a Parallella, to an Activa, to one of these Intel Xeon Phi's, to GPUs, to AMD CPUs, etc. Initially in the Paraphrase project, we're just looking at CPUs and GPUs just to keep the complexity space small enough that we actually get some results out of the project. But by the end of the project, we should be in the stage, hopefully, to look at other architectures too. Yeah. Even things like FPGAs, perhaps.
Yeah, that's important to keep the, and I'm noticing that the idea of something resembling, you know, a Java shared memory concurrency, you know, doesn't even end up on the radar. Of course, it's sort of C or C++, but the shared memory concurrency, the Java, C++, whatever, you know, isn't even on the radar, you know, something you're talking about. I think that, I don't know what point that starts to break down, but I think existing technology is getting pretty close to it.
Well, and existing languages are starting to recognize this. So if you look at the C++ 11 definition, you'll discover that they have some sort of function closure mechanism. And this is precisely to break away from these shared memory abstractions to provide a functional abstraction that can then be implemented as a lightweight thread.
Right.
So they have mechanisms for creating and calling lazy futures, for example.
Right. Yeah. So a laziness method in Erlang would be very convenient. I mean, you can fake it, but having one actually there would be. And actually, I have a cache implementation where I implemented something where basically you pass it a key and a function, and basically it does a lookup. If it doesn't find the item in the cache, it then executes the function to save the item into the cache and give you the value. But that way you don't have to do a conditional lookup and then a computation. You can just do a one or the other. I mean, you just do one command and it works the same. It's idempotent in terms of the call interface.
Yes, yeah, so the key to making something like the Paraphrase idea work is to have strong hygiene at the function abstraction level.
Okay, no, function should take a shower.
Something like that.
Sorry.
take a shower and wash away all your impurities.
So they should go to the mikveh instead. Gotcha.
So one of the things we're trying to do, in fact, in the Paraphrase project, is to take functional programming ideas, these ideas of lightweight threads, independent computations, pure computations, and expose them also to programmers in C++. So the Paraphrase project has two strands. One is targeting Erlang, one is targeting C++. And we have two reasons for doing this. One is because we think that the functional approach is a good one. It helps with the parallelism, and C++ programmers should be able to benefit as well. And the other is to demonstrate generosity of the patterns and the parallel programming constructs. So you should be able to use the same transformations, the same refactorings in both C++ and in Erlang, we hope.
So basically what you're saying is that you're really interested in concurrency and massive parallelism, and functional programming is just a side effect, right?
I would say it is more than just a side effect. I see functional programming as the enabler.
Oh, you missed the joke there.
Well, I got the side joke. Effect.
What? That was intended to be humorous. Maybe it failed, but it was intended to be.
Sorry, it's been a long day.
I'm 2 hours ahead of you, man. So.
two hours and a couple of drinks.
No, all I've been drinking recently is water. I do have a couple of bottles of good single malt downstairs, but generally don't drink them during the week. There's some tequila too, I think. That's mostly my wife's. But you guys should totally arrange Erlang Factory Light St. Andrews.
we have one last year. We're very happy to hold more.
Just don't make it on a Saturday or a Jewish holiday, and I'll try to show, you know.
That's fine. We don't usually work on Saturdays either.
Yeah.
Just avoid it.
Well, Erlang Factory Light New York is on Saturday, but that particular Saturday they picked is Yom Kippur, so I'm a little frustrated by that. I mean, I wasn't going to go anyway because from Israel to New York for a one-day conference is just too much, but still. So it sounds like there's a lot to think about here. It's sort of a lot of just sort of stuff that we're going to need to sort of think about.
Yes, you didn't even let me complete my hate list.
Oh.
That was just the start.
Hate away.
Shared memory. A real problem. So shared memory is a very bad programming abstraction because it inherently forces serialization. It may impose locking, etc. And some of the techniques people have help a little with that, but really you should not be programming with actually shared memory, physically shared memory. Abstractions over it are fine. The one other hate is the idea that memory abstractions have to be the same at all levels. So the programming abstraction doesn't have to be the same as the implementation, and that doesn't have to be the same as the physical hardware. People don't always realize that.
Right, that makes sense. As I've always said, one of the benefits of abstraction is you don't care what, you normally don't have to care what's underneath it. You know, I don't care what model CPU my computer is running as long as it goes.
Exactly. One of the problems at the moment is that the physical architecture is exposed in the implementation. So the implementation forms exactly to the physical model, whether it's shared memory or message passing or whatever. And this is then exposed at a higher level to the programmer. So the programmer is forced to deal with all the details of the architecture. And some people like that because it means that they get the illusion of being close to the hardware. But as I was trying to point out, the hardware is becoming so much more complicated that it's going to become impossible to understand every little detail at that level.
Uncle Bob, Robert Martin, did a talk on why I can't find it. On why C is dead.
Well, C's been reborn as Go, hasn't it?
And I can't find that talk. I'll just put a note in the show notes here to find it. You know, when they were doing C back in the 70s, the goal was to be very close to the physical hardware of the computer. And of course, back in the 70s, when your computers were comparatively slow and simple, that was a virtue. Nowadays, we've got so many levels of abstraction and virtual machines, and you know, I mean, you could be running, I think a fairly common Erlang implementation is you're running the Beam on a Linux kernel, on top of a Linux kernel, on top of an Amazon EC2 instance, on top of, which is running on, you know, an abstracted piece, you know, some level, you know, three or four, so your program is running three or four levels of abstraction away from the physical processor. So, you know, trying to get close to that processor, you know, made sense when you're running on a PDP 11 where you had very little abstraction between your hardware and your code. But now we're running on, you know, some anonymous EC2 instance, you know, running a virtualized system on top of a virtualized system, trying to get close to the hardware, you know, doesn't even make sense. I mean, obviously there are times when you still want it, but you get the picture. What was that? What weird sound? It was a good talk. Uncle Bob, I don't always agree with him, but Uncle Bob, when he gives a talk, is usually worth listening to just because he's been doing this for so long. So.
Yes, I think C is great when you really need to know what's going on the hardware. So as a compiler writer, it's fantastic target language, but it really doesn't provide enough abstraction to write compact.
There was a discussion probably 15 years ago. Somebody suggested to Linus Torvalds that you should rewrite the Linux kernel in, I believe, C++, and Linus ripped into the guy and said, look, you know, I mean, he said it a lot more explicitly than I will. A little more than I will on a, you know, family-natured podcast. But basically said, you know, the advantage of C for an operating system kernel is that you have a very linear relationship between the code you write and the assembly, the machine code that gets executed, pushed through the processor, which when you're writing an OS kernel is what you want. You know,
but it's no longer true, sadly.
Okay, it may be what you want in an OS kernel. I've never.
No. I think it's what you want in an OS kernel, but C doesn't provide it anymore.
Oh, okay.
So I was sitting in on a presentation by Andy Gross from Basho the other day.
Oh, yeah.
It was really quite interesting because initially he was all into the, yes, doing processes and doing all this parallel stuff. But over time he found out that he does want a lot more abstraction, and he's been rereading Leslie Lamport and Pi Calculus and all of that, just in order to get a handle on the higher level thinking that is going on in the parallel and distributed and world. So maybe going more formal is one way to get a handle on this.
Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, as we move towards this, you know, from the 4 to 12 core range to the, you know, up to the 1,000 core range, whenever we do that, you know, I'm thinking Erlang is probably going to break down at some point and not be the, you know, something else will be the final, you know, step there. And Erlang might not be. Oh, maybe I'm wrong. But
maybe Erlang will become the language of choice to compile to.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Well, I mean, there certainly are a bunch of other languages that run on the Beam that compile down to, well, not Erlang source code, but to Erlang Beam files,
mm-hmm.
Starting with Elixir and Joxa and EFL, if you enter those two, if you're into the Lisp, and Robert Verding has implementations of Prolog and Lua, and there are a bunch of others. Somebody's working on a scheme for the scheme on the Erlang VM. That sounds vaguely interesting. I don't know where their progress is, but you know.
Yes, I don't think we're really yet at the stage where we've invented the perfect parallel programming language. So languages like Erlang is nice because of the strictness and because of the process structure. Haskell is nice because of its purity. And but of course, the laziness can then get in the way of exploiting the parallelism.
Right.
So really, there's a point somewhere in between where we have as much parallelism as possible exposed, but we still have some of the glue that you can get probably from lazy execution and a very high level of abstraction.
I mean, one thing that I'm thinking is that, you know, there's a library for Erlang called Erlando. It's from the RabbitMQ guys. I think it's from RabbitMQ guys. That gives you some level of monads within Erlang. I actually use it because it lets you do I use the state monad a lot, variants thereof, because it lets you, you know, sort of pipeline a whole bunch of things together, which I tend to do a lot of. And, you know, you don't just assign 37 intermediate variables, which I find just really aesthetically ugly. And it uses, you know, it basically just rewrites the code as you compile it, I guess, parse transforms. So, you know, maybe some more parse transforms to do laziness and some of the other things in Erlang would be possible. But I just don't know. I'm not an academic computer scientist. That's your bailiwick. My undergraduate degree isn't even in computer science, although I started out in computer science, but quickly defected over to the physics department as an undergrad.
So you're living proof that functional languages are approachable and easy to learn.
I think so. I honestly think Erlang is a pretty good language to learn programming with. And I'm actually teaching a friend of mine to program using Erlang. And she knows I'm saying this because she's standing right next to me. So, maybe. But, you know, honestly, I think Erlang would probably be an easier language to learn to program with than many others. You know, because it does feature a very clean syntax as well as a nice level of abstraction on a lot of things. So.
Yes, the thing, being a Haskell person, the thing that frustrates me, of course, is the lack of types.
Yeah, although you are right. On the other hand, the folks at Costas' group and Dialyzer and stuff, while still not bringing it to the Haskell level, really does some very nice stuff. So. I don't know how much you've played with Dialyzer. Have you played with that at all?
We're actually looking at the moment. We're trying to see whether we can deploy the paraphrase approach on Dialyzer, so we can do a comparison with what Costas has already done in terms of parallelizing the code.
All right.
But we'll let you know how that experiment gets along. From the Haskell perspective, we tend to think of a type as exposing the properties of the program. Certainly there are people in my group who will say, well, the first thing you do is to write the type of the program, and then from the type you can derive the source code.
Right.
That's a fairly extreme position. But one thing that I'm hoping to experiment with in the future, is the idea of capturing properties of parallel programs through a type. So you can say this particular piece of code, kind of as you were saying with the purity analysis, this is a parallel program, this is a pure program, this program has this much parallelism. And when you put it together with that piece of code, then you get this amount of parallelism, for example. So try to reason at a high level about the parallel structures in your code.
You know, and I'm thinking that I know they have some concurrency stuff built into recent versions of Dialyzer, not just in terms of them making Dialyzer itself concurrent, but actually detecting race conditions and things like that. So I'm thinking there's some interesting stuff that's going to happen in that space. I just don't know what it is yet. When I have Costas on the podcast, I will ask him. Remember to ask him.
Sure. So one of the advantages of the paraphrase approach is that if you construct programs using the right parallel patterns, you don't have race conditions.
Right.
Then there's no need to detect them.
You know, I think one of the things we need is a book, you know, published not as an academic book, but as, you know, a bio-paleo pragmatic programmers. Or one of those publishers on, you know, parallel Erlang patterns. I think that'd be a great thing, you know, to have. Because the problem is you guys write academic papers, and for most of us out here in the real, you know, I've read a bunch of Costas' papers recently. Some of them I understood, and some of them I went, I have no idea what he is talking about. It's like, I understood it until he started getting to formulas. And then it was just like, I don't speak this language. you know, because the thing is, a lot of us out here in the industry don't necessarily have the academic computer science background that, you know, that people in academia expect, right? So sort of being able to decompose it into things that those of us in the outside can understand would be very convenient.
Now, using this paraphrase patterns, have you noticed different kinds of algorithms or different kinds of problem solving arising?
So it's the usual thing. If you start off with a particular set of constructs, they drive your thinking. So the patterns are actually quite powerful. Quite often what happens is you inspect a piece of code, and if you have something which is purely functional, you will naturally spot some patterns in it, in that code. And those patterns can often then be parallelized. So one of the patterns that people know from computer science degrees is divide and conquer. I guess, Zach, you've come across this before, right?
Yeah, I mean, when I say I don't have a computer science degree, I graduated with a degree in physics, but I actually started in the computer science department, got about halfway through, and then switched over.
Yeah. So what people tend to do is
undergrad algorithms class.
Sure. Please. So people tend to teach divide and conquer in something like an algorithms class, but it turns out this is actually a pattern, and a lot of code falls into this pattern. So programmers naturally write code that has particular patterns. If you've got a problem which is naturally divide and conquer, then you can simply say, okay, this is an instance of the divide and conquer pattern. Apply that. Bingo, you've got a parallel program.
Right.
That brings up a very interesting point. Is when I first came across paraphrase, one thing that definitely interested me in the whole thing is you're developing a nomenclature in describing how to do parallel processing. Just in the same way that we talk about, you know, the Gang of Four's design patterns in object-oriented programming, we don't have something similar in the Erlang parallel process world.
Well, maybe it's so if somebody wants to – so we often include a shout-out for a project idea. If – you know, it sounds like we need a pattern library, and I'm sure you guys have got some of it that you've worked on, but I'm sure there's a lot more to be done. Is there like a Erlang patterns wiki out there somewhere?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, we always talk about the same things, you know, doing the OTP decomposition with the supervisors and things like that.
Right, but it's
just at the level that we have. And I'm more interested in what paraphrase can bring to it, simply because, again, if I tell someone, oh, your problem, just do the divide and conquer pattern, they automatically know what I'm talking about and know how to approach it.
Right, it sounds like what we really need is a wiki or a GitHub repo, whatever, GitHub repos, of course, come with wikis, I guess. And have somebody curate it and sort of start assembling these patterns and maybe even assemble them into a book so that, you're right. We do need a catalog of patterns, but in order for that to happen, the first step of that is somebody has to say, yes, I'm looking for a project. Let me be the librarian of the Erlang patterns catalog. So if my shout out for the week is, if you're somebody who wants to collate and curate the patterns catalog, and looking for somebody and looking for a project, that would be a good one. Probably call, email Kevin, to even get started. You just do it on GitHub. You don't need like any other resources beyond that, and just talk to people. Kevin, if somebody wanted to do that, would getting in touch with you be?
Absolutely. So we're already created a library, the Skill Library, which provides some of the standard patterns.
Okay. Can you throw a link in the chat here?
There's a link in the chat.
Okay.
So you can look at that. But of course that's only a start.
Right.
And
all
we
right.
would be very, very happy to work with anyone who would like to take this forward. Who's interested in taking it forward?
All right, guys. Normally we do pitch at this point, but we're kind of running out of time. This is already going on 15 minutes longer than I've intended. So I think we're just going to call it here. Any last words before we end the podcast?
Just thank you for giving us the opportunity to be on it and definitely attend Erlang Factories.
So thank you, Zach. And I think what I would say is to all the Erlang, all the people who are out there interested in Erlang, who might be interested in parallelism, please get in touch with us. We really, really want to work with you. We really, really want to find out what your problems are and try to take us forward into this megacore era.
Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.